Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today on the Blackwell Interview of the Month is one of the world's most successful and compelling science writers, Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker is currently a psychology professor at Harvard. Previously, he worked in the Department of Brain and Cognition at MIT. He's the author of six highly influential books, which include The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, and The Stuff of Thought. I was lucky enough to get the chance to meet Pinker on his recent visit to the UK, to talk to him about his new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. That phrase comes from Abraham Lincoln and refers to those qualities which counter our darker impulses and inner demons. In the book, Pinker presents an argument that many of us will instinctively balk at, that over the course of our history, humans have become less violent. From one-on-one violence to all-out warfare, from hate crime to child abuse, the trend line that Pinker presents goes in a downward direction. Not always steadily, and not to the point where violence disappears altogether, but ever downwards nonetheless. As well as exploring this trend, the book also tries to explain why it has come about. What factors have had a civilizing effect on human behavior? What has expanded our capacity to empathize, our ability to find a solution to violence rather than a solution through violence? And in order to tackle those questions, which go to the heart of what makes us human, Pinker draws on the data and insights from a whole host of different disciplines. It's very much a book to ponder, to savour, and to return to. My voice was rather croaky last week, so my questions have been re-recorded in the studio to make for a more pleasant listening experience. I began by asking Stephen if he himself had been surprised by what he found when he began to examine the historical data on human violence.
I've known for years that there are declines of violence that are not widely appreciated. I've known for at least 20 years that the rates of death in hunter-gatherer raiding and feuding were higher than those of even our world wars. And I've known that the medieval rate of homicide was about 35 times higher than the contemporary rate. I also knew things that that everyone knows, that slavery was abolished and that we no longer burn heretics at the stake, we no longer throw debtors into prison. The Soviet Empire collapsed almost entirely nonviolently. I think I was surprised, though, at stringing all of these declines together, that they seemed to form a pattern. That moreover, that the pattern was even extended to cases that I hadn't realized. And that was the impetus for writing the book. When I first started musing about these declines, then I got correspondence from scholars in other fields telling me, oh, here's another one you can add to the list. Rates of child abuse have gone down, and rates of spousal abuse, and the rates of death in warfare across the entire globe have gone down. Then it started to seem like a conspiracy. Why are all of these things going down at once? And that gave me the impetus to write the book.
Pinker presents a panoply of violence from earlier centuries, and what comes across is not just its prevalence, but the pleasure that our ancestors seem to take in the spectacle of violence.
It is shocking to recall not only that public hangings were occasions to bring out the whole family for good, clean fun, but that in even earlier centuries it wasn't just hangings, but grisly torture executions. People being drawn and quartered, which is having their organs cut out and shown to them while they're still alive, that it even extended to pure cruelty for its own sake, not even in the pursuit of some conception of justice as it might have been for the punishment of humans, but that people would enjoy, say, watching a cat being burned to death, just that the cat howling and screaming and struggling was considered hilarious, a form of comedy. And that really does challenge our conception of who we are, that the very same species could have taken delight in such suffering. And in the book, I examine the psychology of sadism, out of pleasure taken in others' suffering, because it seems like such a profound mystery, certainly to me as a psychologist.
Journalists sometimes use the phrase mindless violence. But did his investigation suggest that violence always has a cause and a purpose of some sort?
I think there are some circumstances in which people can be overtaken by a very primitive impulse. You see this in rioting, in some kinds of frenzied ethnic cleansings and pogroms. You see it sometimes in wartime atrocities, where there's a syndrome such that if people are in a prolonged state of apprehension and fear, and suddenly find themselves in a temporary advantage. Say they're outnumbering an isolated and vulnerable member of the enemy coalition. They can explode into a kind of violence that strikes us as mindless and is responsible for some of the worst human atrocities. But I think most violence doesn't fall into that category and is anything but mindless. In fact, many of the worst forms of examples of human atrocities were very carefully planned. The Holocaust being an example, the Gulag, the wars of religion were often in service of an ideology that was highly intellectualized.
I was interested in finding that a high percentage of people who commit murder believe themselves to be committing a moral act, righting some perceived wrong, a form of freelance capital punishment, if you will, rather than seeking personal gain.
Indeed, if you look at the categories of homicides that police list on their blotters, retaliation for some kind of insult or curse and revenge for some harm are way up there. Those categories, including punishment for infidelity or suspected sexual infidelity, probably add up to a majority of homicides, as opposed to literal contests over contested resources, fighting over a bag of money or over a drug deal. And in most cases, the murderer believes that he is acting in the right, that he is basically carrying out justice, that the victim deserved it. Raw predation, namely, I killed him to steal his gold chain and I'm just indifferent to him as a person, are probably a minority of homicides.
One of the major themes of the book is that it was only when humanity began to organize itself into states that the decline in violence became a possibility. The idyll of a prelapsarian existence at a state of peace and harmony turns out to be a fantasy.
Yes, the first historical decline of violence took place when we abandoned or were forced to abandon our hunter-gatherer lifestyle, our harmony with nature, and submitted to the early kings and emperors. Not that they were particularly benevolent, they were actually quite ruthless tyrants, but still in imposing a peace on the population, they reduced the rates of violence by protecting people against endless rounds of vendetta and feuds and raids.
The widening circle of other humans for whom we feel empathy is an important factor in the decline of violence. In this regard, the growth in literacy and book publishing may have played an influential role.
Yes, well, it's certainly appealing to someone who writes books, and I suppose to someone who sells books, to think that books are a pacifying force. But I think it's more than just a conceit that what we do is socially valuable. Historians have faced the puzzle of why so many humanitarian reforms were concentrated in the late 17th century. The abolition of slavery, the first models for democracy, the abolition of torture as a form of criminal punishment, the first arguments against animal abuse and child abuse, and what happened? It wasn't a sudden increase in, say, affluence and longevity. That only happened a century later with the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. But something that did precede the humanitarian revolution was the spread of books and literacy. The book production increased in efficiency, number of books published increased, percentage of the population that was literate increased. And this invites the possibility that as you read more about the lives of others, you become more sympathetic to them. You are lifted out of your tribalism and your parochialism, and you see other people as having minds like you do, and that might decrease your taste for seeing them tortured. I'd be suspicious of this hypothesis were it not for studies in the psychology lab that provide the missing link, the psychological hypothesis that if you do expose people to the inner lives of others via their words, either in print or orally, indeed, you can measure an increase in compassion and empathy. So the psychological studies provide the missing link between the putative cause, namely the spread of literacy in books, and the putative effect, namely humanitarian sentiments.
And as an aside, I was intrigued to see that satire may also have contributed to the decline in respect for absolute authority, rule by force, and the alleged imperative to engage in warfare.
Many social critics have been not so much thundering prophets as smart-ass cut-ups or humorists. Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, George Carlin, even Bertrand Russell, and in earlier periods, Galileo was quite the wit, Voltaire. What is it about humor that can be so subversive? And I suggest that if you humor generally pulls someone down a few pegs in stature or status or dignity or grandeur, and often does so when it's done in the form of a joke rather than, say, slapstick, by slipping in a hidden meaning that when people appreciate it, that's when they burst out in laughter, when they resolve an anomaly by recognizing that someone has been downgraded in dignity. And the very act of getting the joke shows that you agree with the joke teller that some exalted figure has been humbled, and that's what can make it so subversive. And indeed, that's why if you don't laugh at a joke, you often have to be outraged. You have to react with anger. And humorists are at risk of being punished by authorities, as we see with the reaction to the Danish satirical cartoons targeting Muhammad, which resulted in riots and some deaths. The butts of the joke realize that they are losing stature, and if they're not laughing, they have to get angry.
From Enlightenment wits, I now switched across the Atlantic to ask Steven Pinker about the reason for the disparity in homicide rates between the US and Canada. I told him I had often wondered about this, and thanks to his book, I now knew the answer was the Mounties.
Well, if you compare the cultural stereotype of the American Wild West, where the cliche of the cowboy movies was that the nearest sheriff is 90 miles away, with the stereotype of the Canadian Mounties, the Mountie always gets his man, and the Mounties were a part of the Canadian West even before there were settlers in the Canadian West, that might help explain some of the disparity in homicide rates between the U.S. and Canada, namely anarchy versus order. And Canada being more or less a one-dimensional country, of course, Canada is the second largest country in terms of area, but the most habitable part of Canada is a ribbon stretching along the American border. And it's easier to police a ribbon. That is, you just send the Mounties westward or other government forces. Whereas the continental United States is this vast two-dimensional territory where the settlers got there way before the authorities and had to maintain their own rough justice by the credible threat of violence. You defended yourself with your six-shooter.
Next, I asked about U.S. criminal justice policy. If violence has declined as the prison population has soared, does that make locking up a lot of people the right thing to do?
Certainly having an effective criminal justice system, including incapacitating the most violent people, I think is a way to reduce violence. But the American system has gone mad with the incarceration mania, and a large proportion of the people behind bars are nonviolent drug users or petty drug dealers. And clearly the policy is, in the U.S., has overshot its original goal of bringing rates of violence down and has reached the point of negative overall social returns.
Many of the factors to which Steven Pinker attributes the decline in violence were well underway before the 20th century, which saw two cataclysmic wars, as well as a host of other atrocities, conflicts, and massacres. Does this not suggest, I asked him, that we should be worried about the reversibility of the improvements that his book charts?
We should worry, but I think that the depressing, fatalistic response to the two world wars has in fact entrenched itself. That is the conventional wisdom. That's exactly what has happened, that the two world wars have been interpreted as a sign that modernity is inherently flawed, the Enlightenment was a mistake, we're all doomed, human nature is just bound to cause endless atrocities, each one worse than the one before. And I think looking at the full historical record, both the bloody atrocities prior to the 20th century, but also the unprecedented 66-year period that we've enjoyed of without great power wars and without world wars, calls for a reevaluation of that fatalistic attitude. That the two world wars, as we now know, the benefit of 66 years of hindsight, were not a harbinger of worse to come. They were not part of an escalating trend that would culminate in a World War III that was even worse than World War II. This was a common prediction, almost a universal prediction, that was only a matter of time before the US and the Soviet Union would drag the world into a thermonuclear World War III. But it didn't happen. It suggests that the impression that World War I and World War II were part of a trend was mistaken, that it's more, history has proven that they were more like a last gasp or just a couple of statistical outliers that had to happen in some century, but they did not represent the direction of modernity.
The book makes the point that simply looking at homicide statistics underestimates the role that violence plays in our psychological makeup. Even if we never act upon them, many of us have been shown to entertain violent, even murderous fantasies about people we know.
Yes, a number of surveys have shown that a majority of people fantasize about killing someone they don't like. And clearly, we also have inhibitory systems in probably the prefrontal cortex of the brain that ensure that the vast majority of these fantasies don't end up in actual bloodshed. But I think it just shows something profound about the nature of the mind, namely that human conflict is a perennial presence in our lives. The impulse to commit violence is always present, but we also have inhibitory circuits that mean that we don't act on them. And our conscious life seems to be oriented toward events that are probably rare but high in their impact on our biological fitness. So very few days go by where you actually face a murderer, but it just has to happen once for you to no longer have any potential offspring. And the other content of fantasy, not naughty, forbidden, taboo fantasy, is sex, where most people no doubt fantasize about sex far more often than they have opportunities to act on those fantasies. Probably similarly, sexual opportunities may be rare, but when they do occur, they can multiply one's reproductive output, at least in the case of a male. And our mental life, I think, reflects the impact of events, but not their frequency. These are our conscious cognitive processes that are devoted to statistically rare but high-impact events.
We talked at the start of the interview about the appetite earlier centuries had for violent spectacles. But now I put it to Steven Pinker that on-screen violence still holds considerable appeal, and were the reintroduction of the death penalty put to the vote, it's likely that many countries would vote in favour. So is the modern state the sole barrier between us and our violent, even if submerged, impulses?
I suspect, certainly if you judge by eagerness to consume violent entertainment and disposable income forked over to watch bloody movies, we still harbour a taste and a fascination for violence. And it is probably true that we have impulses for vengeance, that if Western countries were true democracies, an awful lot more of them would have capital punishment, as 36 of the 50 American states do. It's not just that the Leviathan is protecting us, but also that today's Leviathans probably implement a more elite vision of how countries ought to be run than a really true participatory democracy would. That even though the majority of the people would delight in seeing murderers put to death, the ones that are better educated, perhaps have more cultivated moral sensibilities, tend to be the ones that make policy in government, leading to a backlash. And one sees this particularly in the United States, that government has been taken over by elitists who don't reflect the will of the people, and to some extent that's true.
Another lesson to draw from history, it seemed, was to beware leaders who offered visions of utopia.
Yes, one of the one category of violence that's responsible for some of the single most destructive events in human history, the Mao's great leap forward in cultural revolution, the Gulag, the Holocaust, the European wars of religion. These were all perpetrated by idealists, by people who had a vision of a perfect world that they were trying to bring about. And I argue in the book that even though utopian ideologies seem vaguely uplifting, like a man's reach should exceed his grasp, and some people see things and ask why, I dream things and ask why not, that all sounds very warm and rosy, but actually it's highly pernicious, because if you have a belief system that holds out the prospect of a world that will be infinitely good forever, a utopia, then you can commit as much violence as you want to bring it into reality, and the costs are outweighed by the benefits, that the ends justify the means. And similarly, anyone who opposes your vision of a perfect world is the only thing standing in the way of infinite good forever, which means that they are infinitely bad and deserve infinite punishment. And it's often been the heretics, the class enemies, that have been wiped out in mass numbers by those who see them as the only thing standing in the way of the present and a perfect world.
Finally, I asked Steven Pinker if it would be right to see the book as an example of tempered optimism about the future, based on the lessons that can be drawn from the past.
Yes, although I note in the book that the attitude underlying it is not so much optimism as gratitude. Namely, we have done something right, and it would be nice to know what exactly it is. That does feed into tempered optimism in that, first of all, you appreciate how much better things are than they used to be, even if they could be better still. And it also suggests that these causes are unlikely to evaporate overnight. So in that regard, it does justify a tempered optimism.
Steven Pinker. The Better Angels of Our Nature is out now in hardback. You can find out more about the book, as well as all of Steven Pinker's other books, and several million other titles besides, by visiting blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 interviews by clicking on the podcast tab on the home page. Podcasts are archived by subject, so you can easily browse through all our science or history podcasts, for example. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another program. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.